Dante's Inferno, Seventh Circle. It's the Circle of Violence. The Circle of Violence has three subcircles, or rings, which punish three different types of violence. Violence against others, violence against self, violence against nature. Each ring has its own dismal landscape. Those who in life were violent against others are immersed, to varying degrees, in a river of seething blood. Those who committed violence against self by suicide have become twigs, shrubs, and trees in the second ring's somber thicket. Those who offended nature, and therefore God himself, find themselves in an open pit of combustible sand, exposed to flakes of fire that rain down on them from above. Ain't too cool. This third ring, in turn, divides into three different types of violence against God and nature: blasphemy, sodomy, and usury. I wonder who's down there in that scorching pit. Stay tuned, friends. Part four of our series on Dante's characters coming up. Character at the center of today's show was a historical person and well-known citizen of Florence. He's located in the second zone of the third ring of the seventh circle among the sodomites. Before we turn to him, some historical and biographical background will help us make sense of Dante's willingness to place in hell some of the most respected Florentines of his time. It has a lot to do with Dante's involvement in the turbulent factionalism of late 13th century Florence. The politics of medieval Italy was dominated by two main parties, the Guelphs and the Ghibellines. The Guelphs supported the papacy in its power struggle with the Holy Roman Empire. The Ghibellines supported the empire. After soundly defeating the Ghibellines in 1266, the Guelph party in Florence split into two factions, the Whites and the Blacks. The Blacks continued to support the Pope, while the Whites opposed papal interference in the self-governing Florentine Republic, and they were especially wary of Pope Boniface VIII, who had aggressive interventionist political ambitions. Dante's family belonged to the White party, and when the Black Guelphs seized power in Florence in November 1301 through a coup d'etat backed by Boniface, their first order of business was to liquidate their political enemies among the White Guelphs. Dante Alighieri, who was away on a diplomatic mission at the time, was one of those enemies. On January 27, 1302, Dante was found guilty of corruption, extortion, and misuse of public funds during his two-month term in the year 1300 as one of the city's seven priors, the highest office in Florentine government. After failing to comply with or challenge the court order against him, Dante was condemned in absentia to permanent exile. The transcripts of the court proceedings state that Dante was prosecuted per inquisitionem, or what we would call a juridical inquest. It was initiated after so-called public reports about his crimes had, I'm quoting, reached the ears and notice of the court. The indictment was politically motivated, without any doubt, and the charges against him were probably trumped up. Yet the court that sentenced Dante had followed legal protocol, and in Dante's time, criminal convictions were far more difficult to nullify than political banishments. As a result, Dante never set foot in Florence again. We should always remember when reading the Divine Comedy that the poem was written by a man who had lost just about everything a person in that era could lose: his citizenship, his homeland, his property, and his social identity. In the letters and works that he wrote after 1302, Dante complained bitterly about the hardships of poverty, vagrancy, and the loss of civic status. In Paradiso, for example, written a decade and a half after his banishment, he writes of coming to know how salty tastes the bread of others. Come sa di sale lo pane altrui. Salty because of the bitterness of having to ask for bread from others, and because of the tears that drench it. Salty also because in Dante's time, as in ours, Tuscany was one of the only places in Italy that did not salt its bread. And in the same passage of Paradiso, Dante also refers to the indignity of having to, I quote him, descend and mount by another's stairs, where descend implies that one's request for hospitality has been denied. The injury of exile, however, went deeper than hardships and the loss of citizenship, which Dante cherished more than any other earthly blessing. What hurt Dante the most was the infamy of his conviction, based as it was on hearsay evidence that resulted in a defamation of his character. Alluding to the way many Florentines simply assumed he was guilty as charged and unleashed a public outcry against him, Dante would later write about wandering all around Italy, quote, displaying against my will the wound of fortune for which the wounded one is often unjustly accustomed to be held accountable. The shame and indignation Dante felt at being chased from his nest by his fellow citizens never diminished with time. At the end of his life, the wound remained as raw in his psyche as when disaster first struck in 1301. The Divine Comedy was incubated and completed within the dark, lacerated depths of a pain that Dante transmuted into a poetic rage against the machine, the malfunctioning machine of secular justice that had unjustly condemned him. The scholar Justin Steinberg, in a book called Dante and the Limits of the Law, makes an important point when he claims that the Divine Comedy was meant to rectify Dante's damaged reputation by highlighting the unreliability of public opinion regarding a person's character. Dante shocked, and knew that he would shock, his fellow Florentines by placing some of the most respected citizens of the city in hell. These are characters like Farinata degli Uberti, Tegaio Aldo Brandini, Jacopo Rusticucci, and others. These are all names that Dante himself considered among the most worthy. By the same token, Dante saves various souls who had been publicly condemned or excommunicated by the church, the souls of people whom most Florentines would have assumed were damned. By dramatizing the discrepancy between public reputation and posthumous fate, Dante, of course, is casting doubt on the accepted court practice of using public opinion as a basis for legal judgments. In Paradiso 20, when Dante's wayfarer expresses amazement that the pagan Ripheus, a minor character in Virgil's Aeneid, is in heaven, the souls in the sixth heaven of Jupiter declare to him, "You mortals hold back from judging, for even we who see God do not yet know all the elect." Hold back from judging. Fair enough. But where does that leave the Divine Comedy, which is a prolonged act of judging and deciding who is damned and who is saved? So either we believe that heaven set its hand on the poem, as Dante claims in Paradiso 25, and that its vision represents God's true moral order, or else we believe that Dante Alighieri, the historical individual, authored its representations of hell, purgatory, and heaven, in which case we must assume that Dante, not God, was the arbiter who saved or damns the souls that his wayfarer meets on his journey through the afterlife. If we believe the latter, then a question arises as to whether Dante was in fact guilty of the partial, prejudicial, and precipitous judgments that he censures in his Divine Comedy. After all, not all of his damnations flew in the face of public opinion. Many were based on the prevalent perceptions, reputations, or rumors surrounding the historical characters in question. How much hard evidence did Dante have for his damnations? Precious little. How much did he have, for that matter, in the case of late repentants, like Prince Manfred or Buonconte da Montefeltro, who, by Dante's account, repented of their sins just instants before they died? These are not idle questions, because Dante's Divine Comedy has in fact had a considerable impact, at least in Italy, but not only, on the posthumous reputations of various historical individuals whom he placed in hell, purgatory, or paradise. Consider a famous scene in Inferno 15 where we find the main character of today's episode. Dante and Virgil have arrived at the third section of the third ring of the Circle of Violence. They're walking along the elevated ledge of the sand pit, protected from the fire that rains down on the sinners beneath them. Dante describes the scene as follows. "We had already come so far from the wood that I would not have seen where it was, even if I had turned back, when we encountered a band of souls coming along the barrier, and each was gazing at us, as in the evening people gaze at one another under the new moon. And they sharpen their brows toward us, as the old tailor does at the eye of the needle. Looked over in this way by such a company, I was recognized by one who seized me by the hem and cried, 'What a marvel!'" Let's pause here for a moment. The sin punished in this region of hell is never explicitly named, neither the word sodomy nor the word sodomites appears in the Divine Comedy. Maybe because even back then, homosexuality was the love that dares not speak its name. Yet Dante leaves little doubt that we are among the sodomites. In the first tercet I just read, he mentions that he did not turn back, recalling the destruction of Sodom and Lot's wife, who, although warned by the angel not to look back, did in fact look back, and was turned into a statue of salt. The imagery of the sinners, quote, "gazing at us as in the evening people gaze at one another under the new moon," conjures a scene of cruising, to use a modern term, for what frequently took place outside the walls of Florence on darker nights, with men checking each other out in the dimness of the new moon. The last tercet I cited is particularly telling, suggesting that Dante knew exactly what it felt like to be leered at by cruisers. "Looked over in this way by such a company, I was recognized by one who seized me by the hem and cried, 'What a marvel!'" In his Confessions, St. Augustine uses that image of lovers tucking at his hem, holding him back from converting to Christianity. Quoting Augustine, "My lovers of old held me back. They plucked at my fleshy garment, and they whispered, 'Do you cast us off?' And, 'From that moment we shall no longer be with you forever and ever.'" So, a sinner down in the pit tugs at Dante's hem and exclaims, "What a marvel!" Now back to the text. I continue. "And I," writes Dante, "when he stretched out his arm toward me, penetrated with my eye his baked appearance, so that his scorched face did not prevent my intellect from recognizing him, and reaching my hand down toward his face, I replied, 'Siete voi qui, Ser Brunetto?' 'Are you here, Ser Brunetto?' That's a line that T.S. Eliot reprises in Little Gidding, by the way. Ser Brunetto. Who is Ser Brunetto Latini? We can be sure that Dante's contemporary readers were as flabbergasted as Dante's wayfarer seems to be in this scene. If we go by Dante's account in Inferno 15, Brunetto Latini, who was born in 1220 and died in 1294, had been Dante's beloved teacher and mentor. He was far more than that, however. Brunetto was a Florentine statesman, a civic hero, and one of the most revered citizens of Florence. He was also one of the great humanists of the 13th century, having authored a very important book called The Tesoretto, or My Treasure, which had a profound impact on Dante himself and from which Dante borrows liberally in constructing his Divine Comedy. The whole opening canto of Inferno has a significant debt to Brunetto's Tesoretto. So what is Brunetto doing among the sodomites? Scholars have searched long and hard for evidence outside of Dante's poem that Brunetto, the father of several children who condemned homosexuality in two of his books, was gay. They've come up empty-handed. Most of them assume that if Dante put him among the sodomites, Brunetto's inclinations must have been well known in Florence. And some scholars have speculated that Brunetto might have made passes at Dante when Dante was a young student. Both hypotheses are belied by Dante's shock at finding his teacher in this zone of hell. Something here doesn't add up, and that's why some scholars are intent on interpreting Brunetto's sodomy in non-sexual terms, as linguistic perversion, for example, since Brunetto had written his Livre du Trésor in French rather than in Latin or Italian. Or Brunetto's so-called unnatural political affiliations, unnatural from Dante's point of view, since Brunetto was opposed to empire, while Dante was definitely in favor of empire. I have a different take on it, which I'll get to shortly, but first, let me emphasize the degree to which, when it comes to Brunetto Latini's place in Dante's Inferno, everything becomes murky and even contradictory. We can't even be sure that Brunetto was ever Dante's teacher, at least not in the affectionate way Dante represents that encounter in Inferno 15, where Brunetto flatters Dante about the glorious future that awaits him, and where Dante treats Brunetto with great respect and affection, declaring to him that in life, quote, "You used to teach me how man makes himself eternal, and how grateful I am for that, as long as I live, must be discerned in my language." Dante refers to, I quote again, "the dear, kind, paternal image of you," and Brunetto twice refers to Dante as son. Ironic, to say the least, in the context of sodomy, or non-procreative sex. There's a universal consensus among scholars that Dante had a genuine love and reverence for Brunetto, and that he is genuinely distressed to discover him among the damned. Yet I've always found that to be an absurd assumption. Dante doesn't discover Brunetto in hell. Dante put him in hell. Not only that, he insidiously undermines Brunetto in Inferno 15, if you consider the choreography of the scene. Dante may bow his head downward in a gesture of reverence as he walks along the ledge with his beloved teacher, yet the teacher walks beneath him, his head at the level of Dante's feet. Even more pathetic, from my point of view, is the fact that Dante uses his encounter with Brunetto to secure a blessing for himself from one of the great humanists of the age. "Oh, son," Brunetto tells him, "if you follow your star, you cannot fail to reach a glorious port. Your fortune holds so much honor in store for you that both sides will hunger for you." Meanwhile, Brunetto is in hell, and Dante is destined for heaven. This fact essentially undercuts the sincerity of Dante's declaration that Brunetto taught him how man makes himself eternal. As I mentioned earlier, Brunetto was the author of a magnum opus called Treasure. And his last words to Dante are, "Let my treasure be commended to you, in which I still live, and I ask no more." The problem here is that Dante had a very different idea about how one becomes eternal than the idea that one lives on in one's work. Dante believed in Christian salvation. Making oneself eternal for Dante meant finding one's way into the eternal presence of the divine. If we take this difference into account, then maybe his decision to place Brunetto among the sodomites was his way of impugning what Dante, from his Christian viewpoint, saw as the sterility of Brunetto's humanism, where sterility means a secular ideology that does not lead to genuine transcendence. If this is indeed why Dante puts Brunetto in such company, that's an invidious way to take issue with his beloved teacher's humanism. Stay tuned, more on Inferno 15 coming up. Along with Brunetto, Dante places three other highly respected citizens of Florence among the sodomites, citizens whom Dante admired and whom he treats with the same respect as he treats his former teacher in Inferno 16. I understand Dante's desire to stress the unreliability of public opinion as a basis for adjudicating a person's guilt or innocence, yet at what cost? In the end, Dante besmirched his teacher's reputation for centuries to come on no justifiable basis whatsoever. To this day, Brunetto Latini is remembered more as a sodomite than as a great humanist, thanks to Dante's portrait of him in Inferno 15. This hijacking of a person's posthumous reputation is egregious, to say the least, when you think about it, especially in the case of someone like Brunetto, who in life assiduously curated his future fame. I love Dante as much as anyone, yet he was no paragon of moral virtue. Yes, he had been defamed, or so he believed, but that makes it all the more troublesome that he was willing to defame Brunetto while feigning to be so fond and respectful of him. Inferno 15 remains a baffling canto from other points of view as well. Sodomy, for example. How are we to understand it? No one really knows. In Inferno, sodomy is punished in lower hell as a form of violence against nature, but in Purgatorio, the second canticle, fully half of the penitents on the terrace of lust, which is the least grave of the deadly sins, are homosexual. As Dante puts it, they, quote, committed the offense for which Caesar, in his triumph, once heard himself reproached as queen. Therefore they depart crying Sodom. Why in his Inferno does Dante put sodomites in the circle of violence rather than in the circle of lust? If sodomy is merely a term for homosexuality, why is it a form of violence in the Inferno and incontinence in Purgatorio? The answer may lie with another defamatory gesture on Dante's part. In Inferno 15, Brunetto remarks in passing that Priscian is also in the pit. Priscian? Who was Priscian, or Priscianus? He was a Latin grammarian of the 6th century AD who authored the Institutiones Grammaticae, or Institutes of Grammar, which was the primary textbook of medieval pedagogy. We know next to nothing about Priscian's life, let alone his sexual proclivities, and Dante knew even less than we do. What Dante did know was that those medieval schools that used Priscian's Institute of Grammar as their manual were hotbeds of what we today would call child abuse or sexual violence against boys. The only reason I can think of why Dante would place Priscian among the sodomites is to indict by association the whole institution of medieval pedagogy, which gave teachers absolute power over the bodies, minds, and souls of their students, a power that they systematically abused. Pedagogus ergo sodomiticus, a teacher therefore a sodomite, to quote a maxim of the times. We may applaud Dante's indictment of sexual violence against children, yet on no account can this indictment justify Dante's defamation of his teacher Brunetto Latini or the Latin grammarian Priscianus Cesariensis. To make matters even more perplexing, in Inferno 16, Dante seems to suggest that he himself, in fact, had homosexual leanings or temptations, and that it was only fear of damnation that prevented him from acting on them. Here is how he describes his encounter with the noble Florentines in the ring of sodomy. Already I was in a place where one heard the thundering of water falling into the next circle, when three shades came running together out of a herd, passing by beneath the harsh punishment's burning rain, and on reaching us, they made a wheel of themselves, all three. And here the language becomes graphically homoerotic. As is the custom of wrestlers, naked and oiled, spying out their holds and their advantage before they come to blows and wounds, so they wheeled, and each kept his face toward me, so their necks made a constant motion contrary to their feet. After the shades reveal who they are, they're in fact three of the most worthy Florentine citizens of their time, Dante writes, "If I had been protected from the fire, I would have thrown myself down there among them, but because I would have burned and cooked myself, fear vanquished the goodwill that made me greedy to embrace them." The word for greedy here is ghiotto, which in Italian has overtones of sexual ardor. And I don't think it's pushing things too far to say that this passage contains a discreet confession that had it not been for his fear of burning in hell, Dante might well have been down there in the pit with them. Stay tuned, wrapping up this fourth episode of our series on Dante's characters right after this. For those of us who belong to an age where everything is relative, where on the one hand means on the other hand, and where uncertainty is our only certainty, there's something compelling as well as liberating about the moral clarity of Dante's vision of good and evil. Dante may have overstepped himself when he presumed to save or damn certain individuals. Yet in the final analysis, we are moved by what I would call the comedy's cry. It's the cry of a wronged, disenfranchised individual who is outraged at the turpitude and political corruption of his world, a world in which popes were scoundrels, power was unscrupulous, and the laws of justice were systematically traduced, abused, or ignored. I borrow the term cry from Dante's ancestor Cacciaguida, whom the wayfarer meets in the central cantos of Paradiso. Cacciaguida foretells the exile that awaits his descendant shortly after his return to earth. Dante wrote the comedy in exile, yet the journey is set in the year 1300, 2 years before his banishment. In his speech, Cacciaguida uses the word grido, or cry, twice. Once in reference to the public outcry against Dante after his conviction, "The cry of blame will follow the party harmed," he warns. And then again in reference to the Divine Comedy in itself, which Cacciaguida instructs Dante to write, even though the high and mighty will take umbrage at his denunciations. Quoting again, "This cry of yours will be like a wind that strikes hardest the highest peaks, and this is no small claim to honor." Every reader of Dante's Commedia, however naive or learned, hears the cry of this poem loudly and clearly. Its idiom may be medieval, yet its clamor has the universal accent of an offended individual shouting back at the world. A world that has the power to crush him, but not to silence him. There is in each of us a stifled, potential, or inarticulate cry of this sort. The reason we read the comedy so many centuries later is because no one in the history of literature has given that cry such a cosmic reach and articulation. The cry moves to the degree that it comes from a flawed, and yes, a very human individual. Dante may have judged others harshly, and in a few cases unjustly, yet the Inferno also tells a story of Dante's recognition within himself of an inner disposition toward many of the sins punished there. His discreet confession among the sodomites is just one of many instances in the poem. The comedy would be unreadable if Dante presumed even the slightest moral superiority over his readers. The only virtue he claims for himself in abundance is hope. And that's good enough for me. I'm Robert Harrison for Entitled Opinions, and this episode wraps up the first installment of our series on Dante's characters. To all of you who made it this far, thanks for listening.
Case bianche baciate da un sole che luce non ha.
Strano sole.
Treni cosmici partono e non ritornano più.
Da quel sole. Paura che ormai corre dentro di me, che
il sol resterà di noi solo un grande falò. Ombre calde che bruciano l'aria al di sopra di noi.
Da quel sole.
freddi.